Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason, in the gallery for SBS World News. Having said this in 2015...
The one thing that is clear about our current situation is the trajectory. We have lost 30 news polls in a row. It is clear that the people have made up their mind about Mr. Abbott's leadership.
This week, Malcolm Turnbull failed his own news poll test, as he was reminded by callers on Talkback Radio.
You nearly lost the unlosable election. I find you politically inept, and I think you should do the honourable thing. Resign. Quite frankly, we go to the election with you, we are doomed as a party.
Well, thanks, Wayne, for the advice. I don't propose to take it, however.
While Wayne and some of Mr. Turnbull's coalition colleagues were all worked up about the milestone, do voters, you know, real people, actually care?
Yeah, I don't really care.
It's amusing that he had that big statement originally about the 30 news polls on Abbott, but it doesn't affect my opinion of him.
It doesn't look good. That was the basis on which he ousted Tony Abbott.
It's a fairly arbitrary sort of criteria. I think the more important stuff is what has he delivered.
Malcolm Turnbull hoping to leave all of his news poll problems behind when he flies out to Europe next week. He'll be joined at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in London by the Foreign Minister and this week's guest, the Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Senator Concetta Fierravanti-Wells, who will deliver a keynote speech about female participation in the Commonwealth. As one woman who has held arguably the most influential position in the world prepares to attend her last chogum after 66 years on the throne. Not a single woman was elected to the parliament.
In some countries, and you've used the example of PNG, we have no female political representation. In some of the countries in our region, we are starting to see a greater number of women in parliament and making their stand.
More from the minister in a moment, but first, here's Miles Morgan.
Thanks, Brett. Well, Malcolm Turnbull lost his 30th news poll in a row this week, with Labor leading the coalition in the two-party preferred vote 52-48%. 30 news polls, the same number Malcolm Turnbull used in September 2015, when he successfully challenged Tony Abbott for the prime ministership. A loss in the opinion polls isn't remarkable for a prime minister, but Malcolm Turnbull brought the scrutiny on himself. He's told journalists there are now more important metrics.
I mean, I regret making those remarks at the time, making the remarks about 30 news polls at the time. But what I promised to do was to provide economic leadership and traditional cabinet government, and I've done both.
And Malcolm Turnbull is still the nation's preferred prime minister over opposition leader Bill Shorten, and he proved that in politics it's better to be on the offensive.
I do have the confidence of my colleagues, that's the first point, and no one, by the way, is suggesting I don't. So, second point is what Australians want us to focus on is their jobs. They want us to focus on national security, and they want us to ensure that great jobs remain in Australia.
News Poll, the monthly snapshot published by the Australian newspaper, is the most closely watched opinion poll. Opinion polls are vexing for the coalition. The government dismisses bad ones and plays down the significance of good ones. The Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, did just that on the ABC when asked about the news poll.
Our position in the polls is actually healthier than what it has been in the period of the Howard government, prior to John Howard winning election after election as incumbent prime minister. So it's not unusual for incumbent governments in between elections being behind in the polls. I mean, we're actually not that far behind, the truth be told.
Even the man who lost his job because of the poll, Tony Abbott, wasn't boasting. Mr. Abbott took part in a charity bike ride, which deliberately made its way through the coal region of Victoria this week. It gave him the chance to agitate for more coal power in the country.
I'm very conscious of the fact that people in Canberra are excited about other subjects. I guess the point I'd make is that we shouldn't obsess over polls. I never did. I don't think others should.
Well, no one seriously expected a challenge to Malcolm Turnbull's leadership in the wake of his news poll loss. Senior ministers actually drenched the airwaves on Monday to support Malcolm Turnbull as the poll came out. But there was a grim warning from the former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce on Sky News.
You also have an obligation not to drive your party or the government off a cliff. Towards the end, near Christmas, you'd have to start asking those around you, what do they believe is the proper course of action?
It's the way politicians think as elections approach and public approval or disapproval becomes clearer. And despite giving Malcolm Turnbull unconditional support this week, the Treasurer, Energy Minister and Home Affairs Minister each admitted if an opportunity presented itself, they would want to be Prime Minister in the future. Now that's an unsurprising statement from any politician, but also unhelpful given the tensions inside the coalition. And Brett, that was The Week in Politics.
In a few days' time, Malcolm Turnbull will fly out to Europe with meetings planned in Germany, France and Belgium. But the Prime Minister's first stop will be London for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, or CHOGM, a gathering of leaders and ministers from the 53 Commonwealth nations. And one of the ministers that will be there is the Australian Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Senator Concetta Fierravanti-Wells. Senator, welcome back to SBS.
Hello, Brett. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Why is Australia's continued membership of the Commonwealth so important? Apart, of course, from winning lots of gold medals at the Commonwealth Games.
Well, look, we have long and strong ties with the Commonwealth. We were one of its founding members. We are part of a very big family of 2.5 billion people who are bound together in the Commonwealth by a common language and our history up to the Commonwealth. Interestingly, two very key statistics about the Commonwealth. One, it covers about 30% of the world's population. And whilst people might think of the Commonwealth as the empire, in inverted commas, 60% of the Commonwealth today is made up of young people aged under 30 years of age.
You talk about the Commonwealth getting younger. It is, of course, also getting bigger. How challenging is it for Commonwealth nations to modernise that union and make it relevant to a new generation?
Look, I think the Commonwealth can play an important role in protecting and promoting what we term internationally as the rules-based order. And this is vitally important for global prosperity and security. Through the Commonwealth, we have, as I said, a common shared values of democracy, of human rights, of good governance, the rule of law. These are the things that have bound us together. These are things that are very, very important to Australia. But of course, when you do look at 53 very diverse members, you do see that nevertheless, they do share some common issues, and some of those will be looked at this CHOGM when you talk about trade and investment and cyber, the blue ocean. I mean, let's not forget the Commonwealth, and I've heard the Secretary General of the Commonwealth use this statistic that about 78% of the world's oceans are under a Commonwealth umbrella. And one of the things, of course, particularly for us in the Pacific, are the number of small island developing states. I mean, let's not forget, Brett, in our region, 36 of the 53 countries are actually in the Indo-Pacific, and about 11 Commonwealth countries are actually in the Pacific. So it's very, very important to us. We want to ensure that the Commonwealth maintains its focus on small island developing states and most especially the Pacific. And we want to make sure that the global interests of the member states in our region are at the fore. I mean, Australia is the second largest contributor to the Commonwealth budget, and we have been a consistent donor to the Commonwealth. We support a whole range of different things, and we've supported a whole range of different activities of the Commonwealth over the years. For example, elections, and we've been a supporter of Commonwealth Observer, a program in democratic elections for a long time.
Women's participation is a big issue in the Commonwealth. The lack of gender balance in decision-making positions in Commonwealth governments. For example, in the most recent election in Papua New Guinea, not a single woman was elected to the parliament.
I'll be speaking at the Women's Forum on Gender Empowerment, and as you correctly said, in some countries, and you've used the example of PNG, we have no female political representation. In some of the countries in our region, we are starting to see a greater number of women in Parliament and making their stance. I mean, when you start looking at some of the countries, particularly on the subcontinent, you've seen the influence of women leaders. But look, it's going to be a slower process in the Pacific, but nevertheless, Australia, as part of our overseas development assistance, we have said that we've set ourselves the target of 80% of our aid being used on gender and gender-related issues. And I was very we didn't reach the target last year, but we got to about 78%.
80% is quite extraordinary. What are some of the projects that money is funding?
Well, let me give you one example, which I was in a country, one country I was in, it's actually in Tonga, and we were on a little island, not one of the main islands, but there had been a project there, a solar farm, which had been developed, and there had been support from Australia, and basically this... about half the workers or half the people who had established the farm had been women, and the majority of the technicians who were continuing the work of this solar farm were actually women. So what we found is by putting this target is that suddenly you start thinking, well, hang on a moment, how could I make a particular project, how can we make a particular program more gender focused? And so this was a very good example. I mean, the Foreign Minister and I were recently in Tonga to switch off the last generator that we had donated to Tonga following the tropical cyclone Geeta, and there we had part of the crews of power workers up in the cherry pickers, and there they were, a group of women out there. So look, this is just one small example, Brett, but as we've gone around, part of the thing is to start thinking outside the box, and we know that many of the societies in our area are very conservative. There are cultural, there are religious, there are other issues that do impinge on participation, but through particularly our Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development, which has been our flagship program in the Pacific, $320 million over 10 years, we've seen good results in certain parts. For example, in PNG, when I was up in the highlands at Goroka, we started to see women working with their husbands and program in terms of coffee growing.
It must be quite surprising in some of these patriarchal countries to see a female foreign minister and a female minister for international development arriving. Have you raised a few eyebrows on some of those islands, Minister?
Well, I must say, though, when we went on our bipartisan trip last year, we went, there was a foreign minister, international development and the Pacific minister, a foreign shadow minister and a foreign female, all four of us got off this plane, and it was really quite good actually. And I do remember in one of the countries that we visited, we certainly got a very, very good reception at an event that we went to, all four of us. But look, this is important as well, because our presence and our work and the work that we do is certainly one where we seek to share, but also it's certainly demonstrating what women can do. Having said that, Brett, can I just say in some Pacific Island countries, I mean, look at a country like Samoa. Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister, Fiame, and last time there were five women who were elected to their parliament. So we are seeing some progress. We're also seeing, of course, one of the key issues, of course, is domestic violence. It is a problem. It's a problem in Australia, but in the Pacific area, it's even more of a problem, Brett. In some of the countries, we're seeing just such high levels of domestic violence. And again, these are things that we work towards assisting and assisting women to have a voice, but it's a slow process.
It's a pretty shocking situation. I did look at some of the statistics looking at the program for CHOGM. In some countries, for example, the Solomon Islands, 2 out of 3 women will experience physical or sexual violence. Vanuatu, 3 out of 5 women have been physically and sexually abused by their partner. And the one that really shocked me was Fiji. Every day, 43 women are injured, 1 is permanently disabled, and 71 lose consciousness as a result of domestic violence. Those figures are extraordinary.
They are extraordinary, Brett, and this is a major issue, but it's an issue that is a very complex one, but it's also an issue where I think that there are cultural, there are religious, there are a whole range, education, a whole range of different things that all combine to make this a very complex issue. Now, from Australia's perspective, by doing what we've done, and certainly in our contribution through our overseas development assistance, by placing gender as a cross-cutting issue and at the forefront, we have been able to influence at some of the way that things are done. One of the things that we've started to see is the enactment of family protection legislation. And what that's actually done is meant that women then have some form of recourse by a legislative framework that enables them to then seek orders, go to the police, seek an order, do that sort of stuff. And then that means that there's a certain degree of sanction that then comes into the equation for that perpetrator of that violence. We're starting to see more women in the police forces. One of the positives that's come out of Ramsey is that I think it was last year's recruits, a third of them were women in the Royal Solomon Islands police force. So these are the sort of things we're starting to see. So it's not going to be one thing and one thing alone, Brett. It's a complex issue where there are different components to it. But if you do start seeing at least some legislative framework, at least some increasing in female police, at least some growing comprehension in the sort of social fabric of those countries, and then you starting to see the contribution and the financial contribution that women can make to the family economy, then you start to see some openings.
You've spoken out about quotas in your own party. Do you think that quotas could perhaps help in some of these Commonwealth nations?
Look, I think every country is going to be different, Brett. Certainly from my perspective in a country like Australia, I'm not a supporter. But what we have seen, some different frameworks that have resulted in women being elected without the need to invoke quotas. But as I said, each country has its own set of complex arrangements, and there's always the issue of a quota versus merit. And whereas in a country like Australia, that discussion is a discussion that's very able to be had, but for some countries, that part of it doesn't actually, you don't even get to that point. It's actually, you're breaking all sorts of, have to break all sorts of barriers to actually get there. But we have seen in some countries where there have been numbers set aside for women, and in some countries they haven't even had to invoke those systems. So bit by bit, whether it's at the local government level, at the provincial level and at the national level, we are starting to see some things.
Speaking of Australian persistence, we've been knocking on the European Union's door for decades now, trying to secure a free trade agreement. How are those negotiations going, not just with Brussels, but also London, as Brexit quickly becomes a reality?
They're both very important opportunities, and we're very pleased that on both fronts, Minister Chobo has been progressing both of those. And European Union, of course, we're very pleased that is progressing. And certainly from Australia's perspective, we know through our various discussions with different countries that there is support for an agreement with Australia, and of course that will progress. On the Brexit, post-Brexit front, just the other day, the Secretary for Trade from Britain was here and having discussions on this very issue with Minister Chobo on the Gold Coast. So both are progressing and both have good opportunities for Australia.
The government thinks we can do a deal with both.
Well, I'll leave that to Minister Chobo. Australia has a lot to offer across a whole range of different areas and a whole range of different commodities, so I'm sure that we will be able to do that. But certainly the indications that have been given by the UK augur well, hopefully, for greater trade between not just Australia, but I think that certainly the indications that have been given by the United Kingdom towards the Commonwealth, I think augur well for a stronger Commonwealth into the future. Some of the fastest growing economies are in our region. And when you do look at where the growth areas, the Indo-Pacific area is one of the fastest growing areas in the world. And indeed, four of Australia's top 10 trading partners are Commonwealth members: the United Kingdom, New Zealand, India and Singapore. So I think the scope of the Commonwealth is something to be explored, and I certainly think that the United Kingdom will certainly be doing that.
And just a few days after Malcolm Turnbull touches down from France, we'll have a very special visitor from Paris. The French President Emmanuel Macron will be here in Australia, his first visit. He is someone who also has a big interest in the Pacific.
We know that here in the Pacific, France, of course, has an active engagement with Australia and New Zealand. We are part of the France agreement framework, and we have worked very, very cooperatively together in the Pacific, particularly in relation to humanitarian response and the various disasters. Seven of the 10 most disaster-prone countries are actually in our region, and the Pacific has certainly seen its fair share of disasters. We talk about unreported, illegal and unregulated fishing. We talk about transnational crime. We talk about drug trafficking. We talk about people trafficking. We talk about those sort of issues. And indeed, thanks to the assistance that has been given to us by the French authorities in New Caledonia, some of the biggest shipments of drugs between the United States and Australia have been hauled, or some of the biggest hauls that we've seen has been as a consequence of the work and the assistance that has been rendered to Australia by the French authorities in New Caledonia. So we see that as an important relationship.
Minister, your portfolio is fascinating and one that we don't talk about enough. Thank you so much for your insights,
Brett,
and look forward to seeing you in London in a few days' time.
Thank you very much, Brett. Thanks a lot.
And we'll bring you next week's edition of The Gallery from Chogham. Have a great weekend.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.